The following is a recording of Admiral Cecil Haney presenting China's Doctrines on Space, Cyber Warfare, and its Nuclear Program on January 10th, 2020.
I'll briefly introduce myself. My name is John Gilbert. I've been in the audience for a number of years and on the board, and was asked to be president for this coming year. I'd like to start off today by mentioning a couple things. What a great turnout. It doesn't look like there are many empty seats. And I think that probably reflects the fact that we've had a stressful week. There's been a lot going on, and there might be even more things that happen in the future. We did not contrive world events to revolve around today's speaker, however. But I'm sure he'll have a couple of questions based on his experience and the things that I know he's going to say. I do want to make a couple of quick announcements here. The evening speaker series, good news and bad news about that. The first session is going to be on the 21st, and Bing West, who's a local resident and co-wrote Jim Mattis's recent professional biography, will be the speaker. That's the good news. The bad news is it's sold out. There is a waiting list, but usually we don't get too far into the waiting list for evening speaker series. And in 2 weeks, we're going to have another speaker, and we will not conspire to move world events around that. But Sean McFate, who's the author of this book called The New Rules of War, is going to be our speaker. That book was recently selected by The Economist as one of its outstanding books of the year. So start getting your questions ready for 2 weeks from now, because I think some things are going to happen. I would like to briefly introduce a couple of people here who've provided multi-generational support to one of our outreach programs to the high schools. Elizabeth, could you stand briefly? And Matthew Aguiar. Okay. Now, Matthew didn't go to school here in Beaufort County. He's a student at the University of Akron, down here visiting his family in January, go figure, and took the time with Elizabeth to go to one of the high schools yesterday and talk about some of the countries of interest to the students there who are going to be representing that country's and their school's interests in a competitions in Columbia and in Georgia later this spring. So having said all that, some of you probably noticed that we were handing out cards at the door. And I'd like to ask our membership coordinator, Joan Lemoyne, to step up and talk to you a little bit about that briefly. Thanks, Joan.
Thanks, John. And in addition to welcoming you here today, for many of you, I want to say Happy New Year, because having worked at the membership table, I know for many of you, it's the first time you've been here this program year. So Happy New Year. If you're like most of the members today, you are here because someone brought you as a guest or referred you. And you can probably tell me exactly who that person was. For my husband and myself, that was Linda and Tom Hennessy, who brought us to a World Affairs meeting on Main Street. So we think you are very influential in letting other people know about World Affairs. So we've got these postcards that we handed out to you. If there's a person you think would be interested in knowing more about World Affairs, please write their name and address there. Leave it with us as you depart today, and we will mail it. Or if you don't know their address, you want to bring a postcard back next week or 2 weeks from now, we'll take it then too. So please take the opportunity to spread the word about World Affairs, because you are our best recruiters. Thank you.
Okay, and now I'd like to introduce our program committee chairman, Ben Kennis, who will introduce the speaker.
Thank you, John. We are pleased to welcome today retired Admiral Cecil Haney. Before retiring from the United States Navy, Admiral Haney served as commander of U.S. Strategic Command, which is, at the time, one of the 9 combatant commands under the Department of Defense. U.S. STRATCOM, as it's known, is responsible for, among other things, the global command and control of U.S. strategic forces to meet decisive national security objectives, including nuclear forces, missile defense, space, cyberspace, and electronic warfare. Before taking command at U.S. STRATCOM, Admiral Haney served as commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet based in Honolulu, responsible for the operations and readiness of the U.S. Navy fleet located in the Pacific and in the Indian Oceans, and also deputy commander of U.S. STRATCOM at that time. His career as a submariner included a variety of operational and command assignments at sea and ashore. He also served as member of the congressionally mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission that produced a detailed report in 2011 and with recommendations for improvement. Among the many other decorations, Admiral Haney received the Navy Distinguished Service Medal, the Defense Superior Service Medal, the Legion of Merit, the Navy Commendation Medal, and the Navy Achievement Medal. He was a 1998 Admiral James Bond Stockdale Leadership Award recipient while in command of the fast attack submarine USS Honolulu. He received master's degrees in national security strategy from the National Defense University and in engineering acoustics and in systems technology from the Naval Postgraduate School. The Admiral is a 1978 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. In retirement, Admiral Haney serves on the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Board of Managers and is co-chair for the China-U.S. Dialogue on Strategic Nuclear Dynamics for the Pacific Forum of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Plus, he is a member of the board of directors at the Washington think tank Center for New American Security. And with that, Admiral Haney, welcome to the World Affairs Council of Hilton Head.
Can you hear me? Yeah, excellent. Well, good morning, and it's just great to be here at Hilton Head. My first time, accompanied by Miss Patricia, her first time, and what a great community you have here. It's just simply beautiful, and I really commend this World Affairs Council here for the vibrant number of subjects you've gone over and you continue to contemplate on as the year goes on. I think it's very important in our country that we have forums like this that keep people aware of the bigger world in a time frame where some could say we become a bit insular in our thinking in terms of what's good for America, but we're so connected to the world that while you're on this theme of what deglobalization is about and what that means to us, I think it's we're still going to be intertwined and connected for quite some time. Our history has proven so. Well, what is going on today with Iran and the Middle East is, of course, just one example. Hong Kong unrest, Taiwan elections, which I think are occurring like right now today. And the list just continues. So I thank the leadership of this board, John, your leadership, Ben, Kenas, and including me in this program. And the team I had dinner with last night just gave me a representative sample of the elite brain power that this group has. So I really thank all of you for your interest and your participation in this sport of world affairs. I also thank you for what you're doing with the youthful part of the population. We had some discussions last night of what you're doing in high schools and what have you. So highlighting Matthew and your mother, Elizabeth, thank you for doing just that. I think that's an important sport also to play in terms of molding our youth to understand when you can't travel, what does the rest of the world look like, and also what's important to us. We have allies and we also have partners and nations, and it's just important to understand how they think, what they're about, and in many cases, from my experiences, we get some darn good ideas from them too. I did note, looking at your website, your November speaker, Suleiman Khan, spoke to you about China's grand strategy. So I think that was a good primer to what I'm going to talk about today here, given his discussion there, going from Mao to Xi Jinping. I listened to it. It was a very thoughtful discussion, and I am eager to be listening to some of the other ones you have, and I like the way you post those on your website. Today, I'll discuss my personal thoughts on the rise of China's military capability in cyber, space, nuclear weapons, and other advanced technology. What that means for us in some ways forward we should consider as we look at the future. Now, most in this audience, I would surmise, can relate to one or all of these capabilities and issues facing us today as it relates to China. While most recent focus is on trade competition with China, we do hear a bit about China and cyber. 5G technology tops the list with the Chinese technology giant Huawei at center stage, or Chinese tapping into our industry, academic, military, or other data illegally using its immense cyber capabilities. China and its rapid advancement in outer space are less center stage. Hence, there's less news reporting in most channels on their efforts there. Their nuclear weapons modernization programs and other advanced technology areas are even less discussed. Yet, I would argue that in order to have an effective competitive campaign, as discussed in this administration's national security strategic documents, we must include these areas too, as we look to deal with China's Belt and Road initiatives, their pursuit for regional dominance, and their drive in their role as a superpower. So, while I will break these into discrete areas of cyberspace, nuclear weapons, and advanced technologies, I hope to emphasize we have to look at these and China's other instruments of power holistically, and have a U.S. comprehensive strategic approach to deal with these responsibly. So first, cyber. I think it is clear to most in this room the dependency we have as a country on the internet and cyberspace in terms of our democratic way of life and our ability to compete globally, economically. China, too, understands its inherent value and has organized significant military capabilities in this area. For China, it's all about information control. In a 2019 Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, report, it states that, quote, authoritative People's Liberation Army, which I'll refer to as PLA, writings identify controlling the information domain, sometimes referred to as information dominance, as a prerequisite for achieving victory in a modern war and as essential for countering outside intervention in a conflict. It goes on to say that the PLA's broader concept of the information domain and of information operations encompasses the network, electromagnetic, psychological, and intelligence domains. Now, President Xi has overseen the expansion of Chinese cyber forces by consolidating and growing these forces into what they call the Strategic Support Forces. And I will talk more about these forces also when I discuss their space operations. It is publicly discussed that in late 2015, Chinese consolidated its cyber elements of the former PLA General Staff 3rd, their Technical Reconnaissance, and 4th, their Electronic Countermeasure and Radar departments, and their Informatization Department as part of this new combat force called the Strategic Support Force. In fact, President Xi has given the goal of China becoming a cyber superpower to promote the deepening development of military-civilian integration for cybersecurity and informatization. Further to this directive are instructions to implement civil-military integration systems, cybersecurity projects, and innovation policies. That's, quote, right out of what they publicize. So from a military standpoint, we have to suspect cyber will be used by the Chinese for surveillance, infiltrate operational plans, and disrupt logistical operations. But given the emphasis on data, we can expect China to want to poison key military data as part of their campaign to impact U.S. decision makers or social media to influence general populations. Their emphasis on the control of information, called informatization, I mean, that was a word I only came across in studying China some years ago. I don't use that in any other forum. But it's interesting that they use it all the time, part of their doctrine. I would argue it's not limited to military operations, but to shape information on the world stage to influence perceptions in all areas of influence, diplomatically, economically, and militarily. We see this in China today, in their efforts to control how the internet is used and how their population gets information. Given top leadership of China's direction in this area, we can expect them to grow this capability using other key technologies, 5G, big data, machine learning, quantum physics, quantum computing. They want to be leaders in each of these areas and are in some regions, they are already using some of this capability on parts of their own population. Frequently, we hear reports of Chinese exploitations using cyber. Here are just a few from a Center for Strategic and International Studies, a report they put out. December 2019, an alleged Chinese state-sponsored hacking group attacked government entities and managed service providers by bypassing the two-factor authentication used by their targets. Now, we use two-factor in a lot of cases today, particularly in the banking industry, to protect our property. In October 2019, Chinese hackers engaged in a multi-year campaign between 2010 and 2015 to acquire intellectual property from foreign companies to support the development of their Chinese airliner, the C919. September 2019, Chinese state-sponsored hacking groups responsible for attacking against three U.S. utility companies in July 2019 was found to have subsequently targeted 17 others. August 2019, China used compromised websites to distribute malware to Uyghur populations using previously undisclosed exploits from Apple, Google, and Windows phones. August 2019, China's state-sponsored hackers were revealed to have targeted multiple U.S. cancer centers and institutes to take information relating to cutting-edge cancer research. And this list just goes on and on. I mean, I found this in some of my research, and I said, wow, current list. And I just gave you a teeny bit of it, maybe 10% of that list really focused on China, but it also includes other bad actors. Now, one might argue, what exactly is a cyber attack versus espionage? But I think you get the picture. State-sponsored cyber activity to have a competitive advantage in many areas, to exploit populations, and in my opinion, to understand the cyber operational environment, to use it as an advantage in a time of conflict, or as a deterrent to being opposed on other fronts, given their knowledge from the data exploited. In September 2018, the President signed out our national cyber strategy. In my opinion, it's a great overarching document emphasizing in its third pillar to preserve peace through strength by being able to attribute and deter unacceptable behavior in cyberspace, including improving cyber intelligence, imposing consequences, building a cyber deterrence initiative, and countering malign cyber influence and information operations. Now, this is a mouthful. Easy to say, hard to do, but something we have to get at. The key, of course, is implementation. And in the cyber environment that is always evolving and changing, I believe a lot of moving parts of this is in progress across our government, industry, and academia. Time will tell, though, if we are truly doing enough, and are we doing it fast enough? Before I became deputy commander of U.S. Strategic Command back in 2011, U.S. Cyber Command had been created, and I got to witness each of our branches of the armed forces establishing credible cyber forces. But it was not until after I retired in 2019 that U.S. Cyber Command was elevated to being its own combatant command, to raise the bar of the importance of this vital area and work even harder with other stakeholders in this area and to get at that direction of that 2018 national strategy. I think it was the right move, and while the commander of U.S. Cyber Command and other intelligence officials have testified to their successful operations to protect our 2018 election process, I can only assume they are hard at work today to protect and defend our democracy and our democratic processes and are in a combat-ready stance. As a country, we must continue to invest on the intellect in this area, and we must protect this work. We must continue to work to keep ahead of other competitors in this area through collaboration in academia, private industry, and government, and work this area closely with our key allies and partners. So next, I'm going to move to Chinese space efforts. China is not just moving to have superiority in cyberspace, but also in outer space, including counter space capabilities. So what does China's 2015 military strategy say about space? It says, China will keep abreast of the dynamics of outer space, deal with security threats and challenges in that domain, and secure its space assets to serve its economic, national economic, and social development, and maintain outer space security. Now, it recognizes the importance of space in international strategic competition. It reflects on Chinese history of advocating for a peaceful use in outer space. That's a good thing. This includes also the opposition to weaponization of and any arms race in outer space. But so far, China's actions show that it is preparing for a war in space and that it has been very active in developing and testing counter space capability. Given Chinese economic growth, one would expect China to pursue space development to support its economy and way of life. Hence why they went to the other side of the moon, perhaps. So today, though, we see Chinese investments in satellites for intelligence and reconnaissance, communications, satellite navigation, and meteorology. They are also involved in human space flight and robotic space exploration. Now, to keep this topic unclassified, I will again quote some of the observations from this DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, report on China's military released last year. In this area, it states, China continues to develop a variety of counter-space capabilities designed to limit and prevent an adversary's use of space-based assets during a crisis or conflict. In addition to research and possible development of satellite jammers and direct energy weapons, China has probably made progress on kinetic energy weapons, including the anti-satellite missile system tested in July of 2014. I remember that one clearly. I was commander, U.S. Strategic Command at the time frame. The Chinese said in their news media, it was just a ballistic missile test, just like you in the U.S. do, when in reality, it was an anti-satellite test. Fortunately, in 2014, it didn't hit anything kinetically and create a bunch of debris. China is employing more sophisticated satellite operations and is testing on-orbit dual-use technology that could be applied to counter-space missions. So they are busy, and they are not transparent in this area. Not that I would expect them to be. There is a bit of a say-do gap, as I have observed. Numerous unclassified publications, including Chinese writings, emphasize how the strategic support forces I mentioned earlier, including the PLA's space, cyber, and electronic warfare capabilities, are grouped into a force that enables cross-domain synergy. That's what they're after. Even with its non-transparency in this area, the DIA reports that China has not publicly acknowledged the existence of any new programs since it confirmed it used its anti-satellite missile to destroy a weather satellite in 2007. Now, that one was a bit hard to cloak because when they did so, it created more debris than any other event in space that we've had since we've been in space. Their writings go on to say, PLA writings emphasize the necessity of destroying, damaging, and interfering with the enemy's reconnaissance and communication satellites, suggesting that such systems, as well as navigation and early warning satellites, could be among the targets of an attack designed to blind and deafen the enemy. In that 2007 anti-satellite ground-based missile launch into space, impacting their defunct weather satellite, it created thousands of pieces of debris moving at incredible speeds in orbit. As stated in a 2016 Space News article, the event led to 3,400 pieces of debris, more than half of which is expected to still be in orbit in 2027. Well, the good news is China's not done another test generating this level of debris that threatens other assets since 2007. It doesn't take much. A small piece of debris impacting another space satellite or manned spacecraft can have dramatic effects. Hence, operational space assets such as the International Space Station has had to maneuver to avoid impacts with some of this debris. Clearly, China knows from keen observations of our recent wars that the U.S. military has a dependency on space, and we can expect that a conflict with China will involve threats to our critical military and commercial space assets. So to deal with these threats to our outer space capability, this administration's space strategy states that the United States will seek to deter, counter, and defeat threats in the space domain that are hostile to the nation's interests and its allies. This is to be done by transforming to more resilient space architectures, strengthening deterrence and warfighting options, and if deterrence fails, to counter threats by adversary and their hostile intent. Improving foundational capabilities, structures, and processes, and fostering conductive domestic and international environments by streamlining regulations, policies and processes to better leverage and support U.S. commercial industry and by pursuing bilateral and multilateral engagements to enable human exploration, promote burden sharing, and marshal corporate threat responses. So that's the plan. But a lot of the capability I can't talk about here because it's highly classified. So I will talk about not capability, but some of the organizational changes that have occurred. Since I retired, whereas U.S. Strategic Command before retiring had space and cyber as part of their formal portfolio, space now is moved into this newly created organization called U.S. Space Command. It's our 11th combatant command. And it's a good thing because moving this mission gives it even more emphasis that it deserves. The administration also sought congressional approval for a space force as a separate military force, which was created by the Congress and the President's signature here recently on the last bit of authorization bills that were signed out here in December. Now, for me, hearing about this new force, you know, we have Navy, Marines, Army, et cetera, and now a Space Force, I'm hoping that this force has no age limit, and perhaps I can enlist in it, because I think it's a very important and meaningful move that our country has made. And I think it's going to be an exciting field. So in addition to these organizational restructuring, I hope that the U.S. will similarly follow the strategic guidance with robust investments in innovative solutions through adequate research and development and fielding of advanced and cost-effective solutions. Just like cyber, we need a corresponding robust educational program to continue our generation of key scientists, mathematicians, and engineers, as well as policymakers that can continue to give the United States advantages in space and thoughtful approaches to address this Chinese competition for the foreseeable future. So now, finally, what about China's nuclear arsenal and its modernization? China continues to make significant military investments in both nuclear and conventional capabilities. While I will stay away from discussing advances in its conventional capabilities, one must appreciate the fact that China is also pursuing advances in its reconnaissance surveillance, command and control, cyber, as I mentioned, space capabilities that support the nuclear forces. While China periodically reminds us of its stated no first use policy, nuclear policy, these developments, coupled with the lack of transparency on nuclear issues, such as force disposition and size, impact regional and strategic stability. China is using that wealth to modernize its nuclear forces by enhancing existing silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, conducting flight tests of new road mobile ballistic missiles, developing a follow-on mobile intercontinental ballistic missile system capable of carrying multiple warheads. Strategic modernization also extends to their naval capabilities as China continues testing and integration of a new ballistic missile submarine, their first sea-based strategic nuclear deterrence. In Chinese military strategy that they put out in May of 2015, it states, quote, "The nuclear force is a strategic cornerstone for safeguarding national sovereignty and security. China has always, in their words, pursued the policy of no first use of nuclear weapons and adhered to a self-defense nuclear strategy. China unconditionally will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states." Notice that distinction, or in nuclear weapons-free zones, and will never enter a nuclear arms race with any other country, end quote. That's what they say in their strategic documents. Notice, though, the modernization program I just talked about may go beyond that kind of thinking. It goes on to say, China will optimize its nuclear force structure, improve strategic early warning, command and control, missile penetration, reaction, and survivability and protection, and deter other countries from using or threatening to use nuclear weapons against China, something you would expect them to say in that regard. So back to this DIA report I referenced earlier. What does it say about all this? It says, as of 2017, the Chinese Air Force has been reassigned a nuclear mission, probably with the development of a strategic bomber. The bomber's deployment would provide China with its first triad of nuclear delivery capabilities dispersed across land, sea, and air. PLA writings express the value, though, of launch on warning nuclear posture, an approach to deterrence that uses heightened readiness, improved surveillance, and streamlined decision-making processes to enable a more rapid response to enemy attack. These writings highlight the posture's consistency with China's no-first-use policy. China is working to develop a space-based early warning capability that their ballistic missile submarine deterrent patrols require to safeguard the integrity of nuclear release authority and for a larger, more dispersed force. So today, while the number of Chinese nuclear weapons dwarfs that, of course, of the United States and of Russia, it is a formidable force that is growing in capability that must be considered in any conflict involving the United States and China. The United States strategy, our strategy to counter this, involves what's called the Nuclear Posture Review. And the latest one of those was signed out also in 2018. It states that direct military conflict between the United States and China would have the potential for nuclear escalation. It also continues with that our tailored strategy for China is designed to prevent Beijing from mistakenly concluding that it could secure an advantage through a limited use of its theater nuclear capabilities, or that any use of nuclear weapons, however limited, is acceptable. And that the United States will maintain the capability to credibly threaten intolerable damages Chinese leaders calculate costs and benefits, such that the costs incurred as a result of a Chinese nuclear employment at any level of escalation would vastly outweigh any benefit. And, of course, the United States is prepared to respond decisively to Chinese non-nuclear or nuclear aggression. So it spells this out clearly in that 2018 strategic document called the Nuclear Posture Review. With this strategy includes a U.S. modernization program to U.S. nuclear forces, including platforms, weapons, and command and control systems. You see, in order to have effective strategic nuclear stability, our nuclear deterrence requires more than just nuclear delivery platforms such as our intercontinental ballistic missiles, our submarines, and our bombers. It fundamentally requires timely intelligence and a synthesis of dedicated sensors to provide effective early indications and warning of impending threats, assured command and control and communications to move that information to key decision makers, missile defense against a limited set of rogue nations, resilient space and cyberspace architecture, a robust conventional force, credible nuclear weapons and their enabling infrastructure, and effective policies, treaties, and non-proliferation activities. Taken together, this deterrent capability must ensure, even in crisis, strategic stability will remain intact. It requires any adversary to understand that they will not get the benefits they seek, and the cost will be too much to bear if they employ theirs. So I believe the current program of record can provide that tailored strategic stability we seek, but it requires a long-term investment across many administrations in order to get there, because our systems today, while effective, are archaic, and they won't do us the service it needs for the foreseeable future, particularly when you look at the modernization done by China and also Russia, I might add. So, to wrap up, I would hope you would take away a couple of things. One being that we must be proactive in addressing Chinese competition through the lens of their cyber, space, and nuclear capabilities while formulating and executing a comprehensive approach in dealing with China's capability across all of our instruments of national power, diplomatically, informational, military, and economics. We can't look at each one of these in isolation. We must couple these with our overall strategic capabilities. This comprehensive approach requires a full team approach, following that strategic guidance I mentioned, even while we address other problems in the world, for example, what's going on in the Middle East. This team is more than just a whole of government approach. When we look at things like Taiwan and alternative scenarios. Our budgets need to be passed on time, but they also must balance our ends, ways, and means, because our national treasure and our debt is also important in this long-term competition, I would argue. I've mentioned over again, but I'll bang on the table one more time, in the importance of our education and training programs to support these strategies in our long-term competition. And that includes more of the entire population of the United States and not just parcels of it. We must not just pay attention to the multi-domain approach of China's rise and President Xi's goals, but address those areas in a meaningful and cost-effective way. Now, we are a great nation. As I've traveled around in a variety of different things I was involved with in the military and since I've retired, and I've seen that we have pockets of just some bright, talented people. We have academic, commercial, and government brain power to apply to the problem. But we must synchronize that capability for a long-term competition. Hopefully this was of interest to you, and I thank you for what you do, and I stand by for your questions.